Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. This edition of 411 Teen talks with the Common Sense Team. The Common Sense Team consists of IB students from Rickards High School with diverse political affiliations. The Common Sense Team seeks to maintain a substantive political dialogue, analyzing and evaluating national, state, and local politics of today. So tap into the pulse of young folks. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me here at the roundtable, I'm always glad to see this team. I welcome, coming in for the summer, I appreciate it, Hannah Quiros. She is a student at Rickards in the IB program, a rising senior, and her interest today is computer science.
Yeah, that's accurate. Thanks for having me.
Quinn Huckaba. Quinn, a rising senior, Rickards IB, physics, foreign policy, and dance. Those are his things.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Olivia Saunders, rising senior, international relations.
Hi, glad to be here.
Ian Scantamale is at Rickards. He's in the IB program, another rising senior, and he's into gymnastics and engineering.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming. There's been so much going on, so I can see why you all would come. You know, where do we start? There's stuff going on in politics on the local, on the state, and on the national level. I know, Hannah, we had talked, and you had voiced an interest in examining the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. What are your thoughts? Let's look at that first, and we'll just continue. And if you have issues that you want us particularly to address, just raise them.
I guess that one came first to mind because I know that it was June 1st when it was announced that we were officially withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords. And I thought it was, you know, a funny way to enter the summer and to say, hello, Earth, and, you know, enjoy it while it lasts. But I guess, you know, as an earthling, that particularly struck me because the U.S. is generally considered a leader in, you know, well, previously under the Obama administration, we were a prominent leader in, you know, the fight to, you know, secure renewable, greener energy sources. And it's generally, I know the goal of the Paris Climate Agreement in general is to make sure that the Earth does not warm by more than 2 degrees.
Right. And they want to keep it at 2 degrees centigrade.
Yeah.
And ideally, 1.5, I think, is what they really would like to have at.
And the U.S. contributes 20% of, you know, the U.S.'s global greenhouse, not the U.S.'s, but, you know, the international greenhouse gas emissions. So if we pull out, then, you know, it's much harder to reach that goal. And to do that, other nations would have to double down their efforts, and that's something that's fairly, I think, though nations have been stepping forward to, you know, reaffirm their commitment. Without the U.S. as a member of the Paris Climate Accords, our dedication to meet that goal is really limited, and that freaks me out because I am a huge fan of Earth. It's done a lot of really good things for me. I have a lot of really good memories here, so I think that's an issue that continues to concern me the most.
I think, to me, the biggest issue with the plot of the Paris Climate Agreement is that it's more symbolic of our lack of commitment to solving climate change than anything else, because the reality is that the U.S. is not a leader in climate change solving. I mean, the main international legislation on climate change was the Kyoto Protocol, which did not work because the U.S. did not sign, and it was harsher than the Paris Agreement. And so why Obama came in wanting to change these terms was that he knew that the Kyoto Protocol would not be acceptable to members of Congress who denied climate change or didn't want to see legislation hurt business. And The reality is that the Paris Climate Change, while it did set those goals, it didn't really set a strong timeline for those goals, and it said that each country could set its own personal goals, which essentially meant that if the Trump administration didn't want to do anything, they really didn't have to. It wasn't like a required thing where the U.S. had to do this every single year. It was really more symbolic of the Trump administration's position on climate change that the U.S. would not be a member of international agreements to help, I guess, stop climate change or, you know, prevent harmful climate change. And I think, to me, that's more scary than anything else, because I think that, in general, motions to prevent climate change have come from the private sector in the country because of, you know, mixed political leanings. And I think we did see a lot of that after the pullout. A lot of companies, I believe it was over 2,000 companies and universities deciding that they were going to set their own goals to follow the Paris Climate Agreement. But at the same time, it's frustrating because there was a lot of work that went together into creating a Paris Climate Agreement that would be acceptable to most countries. And it's frustrating that we can't even take the most basic steps and that we probably won't for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
So I am also in agreement with the past two speakers. I think that pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords is moving in the opposite direction from where the U.S. needs to go. Because we're so involved in the emission of greenhouse gases and we contribute so much to the problem, I think that if the U.S. isn't on board for a climate agreement, that climate agreement won't really do much. And I know that as the U.S. is kind of isolating itself when it comes to climate, other countries are kind of banding together. And so the U.S. is also getting pushed out politically for other reasons as well. Like I know China and Germany are starting to talk about working together for climate change, and the U.S. is not in that agreement. And so to me, it's just another step that President Trump is taking towards isolationism. It's part of his policy, and I understand why he did it as part of his political platform, but I don't agree with it.
Well, I think that – I understand why Donald Trump left, because, you know, it was kind of like a financial burden for the United States, because, like, we would pick up the slack for other countries and we'd – you know, like, it's a pool of money. So, like, you put money into this thing and then, you know, the U.S. financially was, like, suffering from this this agreement. So – and also some people think globalism is, like, a scary thing.
Donald Trump some say it doesn't exist.
Well,
don't forget that. I mean, that is a factor, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, Donald Trump does not want globalism, clearly. So, I personally do not want globalism either because, you know, I'm not going to get religious with you, but the Bible says that's the end. So, once you get there,
that's foreboding.
That's the end. You know, that's when the Antichrist comes in. I mean,
Share it. No, we're
so
open to hear.
Globalism, the reason why Donald Trump does not want globalism, it's like a very big religious factor into this because.
But is he religious at
Yeah,
all?
He's a Christian.
Isn't he Methodist?
So he says.
He claims to be Methodist.
Not get
okay, but okay.
So he's
Come
a
on.
Christian. Whatever type of Christian he is, he's a Christian. Whatever denomination. So the Bible says that it's not like clearly stated globalism, but, you know, it was written several thousand years ago. So basically the world will be under one government and a leader will arise that everyone will think is the greatest leader ever. And under this one leader, the Antichrist, soon to become, will just like destroy the nation. And then that's when – or the world. And that's when Jesus Christ will come back and then end it. And then, you know, so on and so forth. So basically, if we get too globalized and too unified as like a world and then to the point where we have one government, that's not good.
That's not, yeah, that's not
because good. That'll just, even aside from religious things, that'll just end in disaster. Because if there's one leader, it's like Adolf Hitler ruling the world. Whatever he says goes. So
I know another. Yeah, I was just going to add that Trump also said that, you know, this agreement puts businesses at disadvantage. Yes, I know.
Okay. Corey. Well, I just want to address the common misconception that the U.S. is like, if we were a member of the Paris Agreement, that we would have to pay for a large chunk of it, which is not true. The Paris Agreement is funded by voluntary contributions. So if the U.S. didn't want to fund the Paris Agreement, we didn't have to. It wasn't a big deal. And all contributions were intended to be domestic. So, I mean, and I don't know about NATO contributions. I know that's been a big thing on Trump's campaign that I honestly don't know that much about. But I know the UN contributions are totally voluntary. And while it's true that the U.S. does fund a lot of the UN's General Assembly, a lot of other UN subsidiary organizations, such as the UN Population Fund, are funded by mostly European countries and not by the United States. Also, with that being said, I just lost my train of thought. Keep going, Dr. Hallfield.
No, as far as the financial part of this Paris Agreement is, like, if besides the money, like, the agreement is very, like, kind of ridiculous if you think about it. I mean, you're setting goals in air quotes for, like, all these countries to, like, limit climate change. But the United States has, like, the leadership position. So we're, like, doing all these innovative things, and we're, like, pulling all these strings and, like, spending all this money. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, like, little countries, super poor countries, whatever you want to give an example of, like, they do nothing. And they're in this, agreement benefiting financially from it. So, I mean, come on.
The reality is that a lot of the infrastructural changes that reducing carbon emissions in the U.S. would cost are, like, they're very costly to the United States because a lot of it has to do with carbon emissions from cars, which is a very big thing in the United States that isn't a big deal in many other countries. So I think that it would be a very costly project in the United States to reduce carbon emissions by, like, a significant amount. But the point of the Paris Agreement was not that we made goals or whatever. It was that we were committed to working towards it. Okay. Not that we needed to do it tomorrow, just that we needed to do it, period.
Which costs money.
Of course. But at the same time, not having an Earth would cost money. So, you know, which one are we going to choose?
I guess in regard to the claim that pulling out of the climate agreement, the Paris Climate Accords was good for businesses. I know immediately after General Electric and IBM came out with very strong statements saying that even if we're pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords, they would continue to put forth effort to make sure their companies were greener, and that that, you know, like, they would do everything that they could to ensure that their company didn't contribute to global warming in any way they could. So individual corporations that are very involved in, you know, the energy sector and in sectors that contribute to greenhouse gas emissions seem as if they were very for the Paris Climate Accords. And I know it's not as if it's, you know, a unilateral agreement that every nation had to agree to. I think you recognize that each nation is setting their own goals.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and I had to interrupt Hannah as you were talking, so it's yours.
I guess I think where I was heading is that I'm a pretty big fan of the UN's belief in the responsibility to protect, or just the belief that larger nations should, since they have, you know, more means to, you know, influence global politics, you know, just global discourse in general. Indeed. That I think that the responsibility to protect extends, you know, beyond political means and to just trying to facilitate the greater good of, you know, the Earth and the world. And I think what was really important about the Paris Climate Accords is that 195 nations came together and basically agreed that though you know there's differences in the, you know, the minutiae of the details of what each nation is doing, they all agreed that that they at least had some sort of commitment, or that it was worthy to commit themselves to the cause of limiting global warming in any way that they could. And the U.S. is the goals that the U.S. set under President Obama compared to many other nations were pretty modest, and I think it's a shame to pull out. I think that even if your religious beliefs make you inclined to, you know, disavow globalism, I think it's a reality. Like, we and, you know, as technology develops, the world's going to become more and more interconnected, and the U.S. can decide to either be on the side of that or to reject that. And I think in the long run, denying globalism or attempting to impede globalism isn't going to help anyone. Is
that, right.
It's honestly become a very politically charged issue, which is sad to me, because I think we should kind of just look at the facts and say, all right, is this a good idea or is it not? But what it ultimately comes down to, from what I've seen, is I've talked to a lot of like politically minded teenagers from around Florida, and it comes down to, do you want to help other countries and use your resources to put other countries first, or do you want to help your own people first? And there are, you know, there are legitimate arguments for
first.
Both. Right. I know there are some people that believe they should focus on solving global warming only in America and just let the other countries fend for themselves, which is an interesting idea. I know that there are some countries like India and Pakistan that are going to have a hard time fixing their climate problem without other nations' help. And again, I'm for globalism. I'm for the Paris Climate Accords. But I think that it's become too politically charged of an issue to be examined.
Look, the Paris Agreement didn't commit the U.S. to solving other nations' problems. It just committed the U.S. to making steps within the U.S. that would, you know, attempt to reduce carbon emissions by at least a little bit. And also, the reality is that outside of the U.S., a lot of what the Paris Accords had to do was foster sustainable development in countries that may not have roads like the United States does, may not have good systems for controlling energy emissions. And the idea was that we encourage developing nations to develop responsibly. So,
but how do you all feel about, and I'm glad you raised that, Quint, what's the priority? I mean, should we take care of home first? I mean, or, you know, should we be aware and sensitive and supportive of other countries?
I think through being globally minded, you're protecting your home, because at the end of the day, I think that the U.S. is, you know, very interconnected to every other nation in the world. And I also, I think that if the U.S., I think Quentin touched on this, but if the U.S. steps back from, you know, leading the fight to regulate or at least, you know, mitigate the negative effects of climate change, then other nations will step forward. And I think domestically that's, you know, we're losing ground. And I think that to be a nation that's on the forefront of global conversation and positive global change, you have to be globally minded. So I think that the two are interconnected.
Okay.
Although I do agree with globalism, I definitely think that you can't ignore your homeland. And I think that the U.S. could do a better job of working on their infrastructure and their education and things like that. I think that they can't ignore those things. And at the same time, however, if you're not helping other countries, then you're ignoring the fact that there's a lot of people around your nation that may not be happy with you, and that could cause the trouble at home as well. So ultimately, I think you have to have a little bit of both.
I'm going to move on to something else, because we can't – there's so many issues, and you all came in this summer, and, you know, we need to try to touch on something else. How can we – forget or ignore healthcare?
Yeah.
I mean, healthcare, it appears that the proposed Senate bill has major problems in it. It reduces the actual number of people insured. It raises premiums for the poor and low income. It gives huge tax breaks for the wealthy. I mean, how do you all feel? What's your position on health care? What do we do?
This bill is being rushed. It's not, you know, if we're going to reform health care, we have to do it very consciously. The Affordable Care Act was shopped over 11 months, and it had over 12 open hearings, and it spent like hundreds of hours of open debate on the floor, none of which we have seen with this bill. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there have been no open hearings.
Why are we not seeing this?
Because Republicans are afraid that we're going to knock on their doors like we did with the last bill.
Well, they are knocking on the doors. I just saw earlier they were protesting at Rubio.
Yeah, well, I know there was with the last healthcare bill, I know there were a lot of protests at Neil Dunn's Tallahassee office, and he was apparently like escaping out the back door because he was so afraid of these protesters. And the reality is that that's why I believe that this bill has been kept secret for so long, because it, you know, Congressmen and women feel threatened by protesters and people who oppose the bill. But if that's the case, then why aren't you making a better bill that actually protects people? We're going to have healthcare reform. It needs to be very conscious healthcare reform, that in the best healthcare reform that we can make. And a healthcare bill that's only been on the floor for a month and a half cannot do that. It's just, that's just reality. I'm sorry.
I think a lot of Republican politicians, I guess I'll say, nowadays have kind of forgotten the central platform of the Republican Party when it comes to the economy in any way, shape, or form. And healthcare is part of the economy. The Republican stance is that you're supposed to incentivize the economy. Mm-hmm. So you have less government, but at the same time you incentivize the economy. They're only remembering the less government part. They don't – there's no incentives for healthcare to improve by private healthcare organizations. They have no incentive to make healthcare better. And so that is a huge problem with the bill, and that's why it's not working.
I think – I acknowledge that healthcare is a very big part of the economy, and that the pharmaceutical industry is, you know, very evil above all of our heads. And they do a lot of really good work. There's a lot of amazing science that's going on there. But I guess just thinking off of Quinn's point, I think that the fact that healthcare is, I guess, so intertwined with economics and pulling a profit, I think that's a problem within the healthcare system in the U.S. itself. But in regard to the new bill that's just been passed in the Senate. Well, it's about to be brought to the Senate floor. Thank God.
Yes.
I did. You know, you would have been jumping that nonverbal gun. Communication. I was like, what? It passed already?
Sorry. But I know the Congressional Budget Office just released their report on it, and I like to look to them because they're fairly nonpartisan, and I know their reports are very well formatted. I'm a pretty big fan. And they said that it would leave 22 million Americans uninsured by 2026 and 15 million by 2017, which is scary.
Right.
And I know that the main goal of the bill is to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but the Affordable Care Act insured slightly over 20 million Americans, which, you know, I think is a very good thing. I'm a huge fan of the ACA. But if it's going to leave 22 million Americans without health care, it's obviously reaching further than a repeal.
Right.
And I think one of my main problems with the Senate bill is the cuts that it seeks to make to Medicaid. And I mean, I think the problem with pulling from Medicaid is that it's a system that's meant to support the poor and the disabled and those that genuinely could not find work that would allow themselves to, you know, empower themselves to purchase their own health care through an employer. So,
and it provides the majority of health care for Americans. I mean, that's just the reality of it. Okay.
And also, on the campaign trail, Trump said that he would not cut Medicaid.
Right.
And that is not being followed through with on this bill.
Ian, do you have any comments?
I have no comments about health care because
it's not your
my specialty
thing. Okay, no problem.
Well, purposely avoided medicine.
Okay.
I got enough with my dad.
But is health care, and this is an ongoing issue, is it a privilege or is it a right? Do we owe health care to every citizen? Are certain ones privileged and they can have it?
I think it's in the best interest of the American government to have a higher standard of living when it comes to health care. I think, honestly, I've kind of tried to figure out what would be the best solution, and I think a good idea would be to have private health care industries, but then also to have a baseline health care program that's not necessarily put in priority, but the private health care systems then have an incentive to get better and to improve themselves because they're not the only healthcare system around then.
That's the way that Obamacare should have worked if it was implemented.
Indeed.
Well, and I think the main idea of Obamacare was that there would be you know, a government-run healthcare provider that would be competing with private firms, so exactly. that there would be competition. And the main problem with it is that there were dead zones, and especially rural areas where mm-hmm. there are poorer people who need mm-hmm. access to better healthcare, where there would be little incentive for other healthcare providers to be in that market. And the Affordable Care Act, like Obamacare or government healthcare, wasn't implemented universally, and I think that's why there were a lot of trouble. There was a lot of trouble with competition, and I know that I love President Obama, and I hate to fault him for anything. But I think that, like,
don't you realize he is the problem?
No,
he is the cause of when everything anything goes wrong. Come on, y'all. Anything goes wrong, they do always go back to Obama. It's always Obama's fault.
I acknowledge that. I think he's having a good time now. I saw Michelle Obama on the BET Awards yesterday. Her video response was very cute. Uh-huh. But I think that President Obama could have, given that the American people were very receptive to healthcare reform at the time, and that there was a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate, that he could have pushed for a more unilateral and universal distribution of the Affordable Care Act, but he stepped back from that. And I think that, I mean, I want healthcare to be a right, but I acknowledge that in the U.S. And in, you know, a country that practices capitalism, which is, like, you know, my favorite economic philosophy, that those that have more means are going to end up doing better. So I think that basic healthcare should be a right, but I think the access to better healthcare is always going to be a privilege.
Okay. All right.
And I agree with Quinn and Hannah, I guess, on that, because I think that, you know, there should be a public option for healthcare, but it should be the basics. I mean, there are certain, you know, we got to preserve capitalism, like Hannah, I'm a big fan. But I think that one of the big problems with the Affordable Care Act was that it locked people who had other options for healthcare out of Obamacare, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like, if you had health insurance through your employer, that was what you had to do. You couldn't have an option for an Affordable Care Act, which I think in itself is kind of odd, because a healthcare system in a capitalist society should provide more options, not less options. And it ended up costing a lot of Americans a lot of money who were now forced to buy healthcare but weren't allowed, you know, a fair share of the market. So I think it's a very complicated bill, and it has a lot of problems, but again, that needs time to fix. It's not going to happen in the way that a lot of Republican lawmakers are trying to rush it. It can't possibly be ready to, like, face America. So,
well, they say it is. Although, let's see. You know, Trump's approval rating continues to vacillate between low and lower. But Republicans also are winning elections. And I think of just the Handel and Ossoff election in Georgia. Yeah. And I wanted to get your opinions on that. Do you feel like Trump is trying to disintegrate Obama's legacy when you look at the things he's striking down? Yes,
I mean, if you're talking about the election in Georgia where mm-hmm. the Democratic candidate almost won, I felt like that was really a...
But almost. Only almost, counts almost only in counts. Horseshoes, okay?
Yes.
So he didn't win.
It went all the way to a runoff. But I just think that the Republican core is very strong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And okay. I feel like there are a lot of people that will go with the Republican Party for a long, long time. Okay. And that's not a bad thing at all. I mean... But I feel like that's the reality, and I think that Trump is kind of changing the Republican Party to be not what it was before mm-hmm. at all.
That's true.
He's confusing the issues. He's mixing in a little bit of Democratic, a little bit of Republican, a little bit of his own personal stuff.
Mm-hmm. He is.
But I think that there'll still be a lot of people that follow him along with it, and I think that there will be a lot of people who blame the last Democratic candidate, which was Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Also. Just a side remark, the Democratic Party made a poor decision by putting all of their hopes on John Ossoff in a district. I mean, I thought he was a cool guy, but in a district like that, to have him win would have been a a total upset. You know, it was, to me, it was remarkable that he did so well, but like...
And didn't he really live outside the district?
You know, I didn't follow it that closely. I know when I was in Atlanta recently, I was seeing,
one of the issues
ads and stuff for it. Yeah. But it was just like a poor decision on the part of the Democratic Party. Like, I don't understand why you would pin your hopes on a race we were so clearly slated to lose, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think the reason why that happened is because after the 2010 census, the way that the districts were drawn, they're so gerrymandered that there are very few districts that Democrats actually have that would be like viable toss-ups that they would need to win in order to regain their majority in the House and in the Senate. And Georgia was one of those such states where they actually had like a viable chance. And they threw a lot of money behind. I read that it was, I think, the most expensive Senate race.
It was.
House race.
House race.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
But,
man, if it was Senate, it would have been intense.
That would have been much more, much more intense.
I think, man, I love the House. I love the personality that shows up there. But, I think the reason why the Republicans are still continuing to do so well is because they're hearkening back to, you know, a retreat from globalism and a focus, they're trying to, I guess, co-opt American values and to associate that with their party. And the Democrats are in the middle of a very strong identity crisis right now between the more progressive wings of their party and, you know, the more centrist branches. And I think the Democrats need to, you know, get their stuff together, figure out, like, find a compelling leader, find, you know, the neo-Obama or, you know, the more progressive version of that. And I think they just need to make themselves appealing again, because I love Democratic values. I love the Democratic Party, but I think that they're kind of off their game right now.
Okay, so you would acknowledge that.
I think that we're still in like the pendulum swing. You know, we had Democrats, Obama, now we're on the way back. So it still has momentum. It'll stop eventually, so we're still seeing that happening.
Okay. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I am talking with IB students from Rickards High School, the Common Sense team. We're going to take a break, but we will return shortly.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You need to get the 411 here on 411 Teen, and we are talking with students from Rickards High School, all rising seniors. Quinn, you had comments and I had to stop you before you even got started.
I did. I was also,
Mike, it's all yours.
Thank you. I was also thinking that Donald Trump really focused on, again, America first. And it was like, we're going to help you, the people who haven't been heard in the past 8 years or so. And I think that a lot of people still kind of believe in that Donald Trump is going to watch out for the silent majority, they're called.
Really?
the people that don't talk a lot, you know, the people that are oppressed, quote-unquote, and
the poor, although he did say he didn't want any poor people running the government. He said that.
Do Trump supporters know that the silent majority was a term coined during the Nixon administration?
I mean, wow.
That's what he's going for, you know?
Yeah. Again, back to the past.
Do you think Trump is creating an atmosphere in which reality is irrelevant?
The existential question.
What type of question is that?
This was a philosophy class.
I mean, that sounds pretty appealing.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what do you think?
I think that reality has existed for a long time, and while it was like,
I think it'll survive.
Yeah, I think it was exacerbated by Trump. I mean, he's not exactly like forbearer of truth, but I mean, you know. Media has been biased and has suffered from poor journalism and muckraking for as long as journalism has existed, truly. So, and it's also appealed to the interests of the buyer rather than, you know, of justice. So, you know, Whatever. I don't care.
It doesn't matter. Okay.
The truth is out there.
And I just wonder, even if that's significant, I mean, does it matter? Yes, ma'am.
I think I agree with the fact that it's getting much harder to care because there's so much that I feel like I constantly need to care about or mm-hmm. else like I will watch my country burn. Because I think the media needs to maybe do a better job of letting me know. I mean, I think that I love we're the media, I guess, to a certain extent. And I think that journalism is such an honorable profession, but Trump is giving them such a hard job because there's constant – he's everything that he's doing is groundbreaking because he's breaking the ground himself. He has no idea what politics is. He's figuring it out. And I know that I'm a frequenter of the New York Times and the Washington Post. I think they're great publications, and I read them online because, you know, I'm contributing to the death of print media. It's fine. But on the front page, I know that, like, typically during the Obama era, there would be, you know, a couple of political stories, but then I would find something about, like, I don't know, the art taker, about something in, like, international relations. But now I feel like the entire front page is dominated by Trump scandal, Trump development, mm-hmm. and I have to I have to head to the science and tech and world tabs mm-hmm. in order to get, like, you know, a touch of, like, global news and, I guess, things that are going on, I guess, more positive developments, I guess, in science and just, like, things that are going on in the tech industry. And though I feel like it's the amount of news that Trump is generating is distracting from other things that are going on as well. And I know that
there – But that may be the plan. That may be the ultimate. I mean,
I'm never going to know
why he's doing
that.
Yeah, the agenda.
Distract us all.
Right. It may. I mean that's a tactic.
I mean, the Democrats are still trying to impeach him. Like,
I know.
And like, I can't. I can't go on TV without hearing Russia.
Oh, yeah. You notice we haven't mentioned Russia yet. I wasn't going to talk about Russia at all today. That's, yes.
That's like, I'm just sick of Russia. Just erase Russia.
Oh, my God. Sorry to all the Russians out there.
we don't want to erase Russia. I just want to say I don't think Trump is self-aware enough to think about whether he's making an environment
you
in which
he's
reality
not
is relevant.
Okay.
But I will say that I think a lot of truth is lost in favor of partisan beliefs. That's for Democrats and Republicans.
And Republicans. Okay.
Yeah, because I think that a lot of Democrats now, because we've been talking about kind of the Republican Party and their views, a lot of Democrats now are – they'll see something anti-Trump and they'll go with it regardless of what it's actually about. And that's not a good thing. I mean, we need to talk about the facts. You know, if you agree with this, then support whoever's supporting that. Don't have it be like a celebrity race, which is kind of what it's turned out to be.
Okay, well, that's wait. A look – Let's look at something else. Okay. Make
no,
it quick.
It's just that, like, I think we also should acknowledge that the media is going through a lot of hard times right now, especially newspapers, and that a lot of newspapers, especially local newspapers, are closing, and Trump sells papers. Sensationalizing Trump sells papers, which has not happened in a long time. So, and you also have to understand that, like, the media is consistently being attacked by Trump, so why would they write favorable things about him? He's closed off his press briefings to them. So, you know, it's... I love the media. I'm a big fan.
Me too.
Well, what's happening? Let's bring things home for a minute. This is Tallahassee in the all-American city. And I don't know if you've read the newspaper or not, but this all-American city has the highest crime rate in the state. Are you all aware of that?
Yeah.
What's going on? I mean, we all live here. What's happening? What does that mean?
Someone who has never been a victim of a crime, I'm not sure.
I haven't either.
I mean, recently, I don't know if you guys heard the records, this two or maybe three students have been shot.
Yeah.
One died,
I mean,
I think.
Yeah, one died, one's in the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole situation is a big disaster. I mean, one of them has already been shot. I know personally one of them has already been shot in eighth grade. I guess he didn't learn. He learned his lesson with his, like, gangs and, you know. I mean, Tallahassee is, I mean, there's very sketchy parts. Like
any place, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I don't know what's wrong with Tallahassee. It's like, you go to some parts, they're nice. The other parts, people are trying to kill each other.
Right, but you do see that in almost all cities. I mean, there's a big dichotomy.
And a big part of it is like the drug demand, because this is like college town. There's FSU, TCC, and then all these college students, like, you know, weed crazy. Once they get out of the house, mm-hmm. they're like, let's do some weed. So they're cool. They're like creating this massive.
Weed. Yeah, that's.
You know, whatever. So mm-hmm. they're creating this massive demand for drugs, which is like, you know, capitalism with drugs, you know? Like the drug dealers are like, let's get this drug deal on. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and okay. then with drugs, there's violence. So
you're saying drugs. Quinn, what do you think? Do you agree?
No, I was just going to add that. I know Tallahassee is extremely divided. It's gotten less so over the past years.
That's but like, a good
there's
point.
Very clear north, south, east, and west. There's very clear differences
and
between
the areas.
And
it's a very racially and economically mm-hmm. segregated yes. city.
Right. Okay? And I think that contributes to a lot of it because I think there's just a lot of divisiveness that clashes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I know every day when I'm driving to the Mag Lab, the change in socioeconomic status and the change in the type of cars that you see at the Mag Lab and on the way there are like, very distinct. And, you know, mm-hmm. love the South Side, love the Mag Lab. But, like, I remember when I was driving there, me and my sister saw a car with, like, 12, like, bullet hole shots. Like, we're feeling very distinct in the back. And when you get to the back, when I got to the Mag Lab, like, you know, there are Teslas there, there are Audis. Mm. And it's, I think that speaks to the way, you know, education empowers you to have more money and to live a better life. But, I know there are initiatives like that. The Mag Lab was like specifically placed, you know, in that region in order to like hopefully encourage, you know, development to come to the South Side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same with the Abbey program.
Mm-hmm. And sadly, I think the type of students that both of those, you know, the Mag Lab and the IB program attract, they typically don't end up hitting their target demographics, or they never really end up truly integrating poorer.
And I think the IB program is pretty integrated.
Yeah,
I think I differ with you on
I
that.
Think
I, yeah,
it just depends
that's
on which circle
you think about.
In the which circle you travel with in mm-hmm. IB. Like, there are a lot of really privileged kids who are in IB, but there are also a lot of not very privileged kids who
I
are in IB.
I would disagree with you on that one.
Yeah. But, you know, it just... Yeah, I definitely get what you're saying.
I think, like, the placement of the IB program, like, mm-hmm. 80% of the people should be, like, African-American, but mm-hmm. that's not the case because, right. I mean, look at it.
Yeah.
I'm coming from, like, 25 minutes away for this program. Meanwhile, these kids are there, like, shooting each other and, like, doing ridiculous things. I mean, and, like, they have this, like, excellent program there, place for them for free with all the resources they need, and then they're not taking advantage of it.
I think the reality, though, is that a lot of the elementary schools and, like, lower education in that area, they aren't there. They're not good sources of education. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to Roberts, which is a very privileged elementary school, and the amount of resources that gets, you know, that gets put into that school is insane. I mean, I have a nephew and a niece going there now, and, you know, they test for gifted at every age. They test for developmental delays, which is, I think, what they call it when it's younger. Or, you know, they might test you for ADD or ADHD, and they work with you really so that you get a plan that really fits the way that you best learn. And I can tell you that is not true at many of the schools
indeed.
On the South
I'm
Side.
I'm very glad you brought that
and
up.
Unfortunately, I think that elementary school and even pre-K, which, you know, it's mm-hmm. expensive and a lot of people mm-hmm. don't have the kind of money to send their kids to those kinds of schools. It's so important in encouraging good behavior and a good education when kids get older. I think many of the kids that come from lower income backgrounds who go to Rickards are very fortunate because they do have access to an education that would not typically be afforded to them. Whereas, you know, in other school districts where there isn't really an affluent population, we've seen kind of, unfortunately, a public school system that fails for everyone, that isn't good for everyone, and elementary schools that are bad, middle schools that are bad, and as a result, high schools that are bad. So, unfortunately, I think that these problems are being exacerbated, not fixed, but I don't think it's fair to blame the students themselves rather than the system that fosters that kind of.
That would be the problem that I have with it. Yes, ma'am.
I really agree with Ollie, and I think that to clarify, I think that the IB program is doing such a good thing by being on the South Side because I know there are so many students there that would like I was going to say, like, never encounter black people in their everyday life if they didn't go to the school. And I know
I don't think that's a very accurate statement.
I know that I was speaking to a kid at a Model UN conference, and he told me that he didn't go to Rickards because he was scared of the large black population. And
yeah,
I was like,
I've had multiple people tell me
which
that.
Which is so crazy because, I mean, you know, big reveal as a black person, I don't know why anyone would think that that's like I don't know. I don't get why anyone would think that would be like.
Do you really not get
a thing
it?
To say? No, I mean no. A thing to say
this,
to me.
When you hear in the news like 2 weeks ago that people are like killing each other,
right?
I think that's not a student that went to Rickards. Yeah, like, I know, but he wasn't at the school like during the time of the shooting. It was he's graduated.
One graduated. One was our grade. The other was you all also in our grade.
Are forgetting the effects of discrimination and bias and bigotry.
Why would you
and
work hard to succeed in a system that hates you? Essentially.
I think that a lot of the students that I think you're demonizing to a certain extent for being involved in gang
you're
violence.
You're blaming the victim.
I think yeah, to a certain extent, they're put into situations where they feel like they have very few other options, and that may be accurate.
Yeah.
So, but. Again, like I think that I really think that the IB program does a very good job of integrating people from higher and lower social. Because I know a lot of kids in the IB program have parents that have gone to like fantastic universities, and that we have a higher amount of people with doctorates and people that are actually doctors that go there, that those are the people that are putting their kids in the IB program, and then we also have a lot of very poor kids, and I think that it's very good to integrate those two things. What I was, I think, trying to say earlier, maybe I didn't word it well enough, is that doing that alone isn't going to stop, the socioeconomic divide that we're experiencing in Tallahassee, and I honestly don't know how you would bridge that.
Okay. Yes, Glenn.
I just kind of want to go back to like the original question, which is it's fine. Which is like. Why is there so much crime? Yeah. And I think it also, again, goes back to what Ollie was saying about, original education, like pre-K, kindergarten, elementary schools, middle schools. Because I know that, when I was in middle school, I was kind of thinking, wow, if I didn't have these opportunities, I definitely wouldn't do a 180 degree change in high school and start doing these things.
Right.
So I think that it's important. I think that we should invest more in programs for elementary schools and middle schools. And start to like try to get kids
and jobs, and housing.
Right. Well, I mean that, there's all that too.
All
there's
that
the infrastructure and education.
That's right.
Well, and I also think that the quality of education is improving, even though it's not really improving for everyone. But even so, educated parents tend to have educated children, and by fostering, I guess, a better educational ideal by more and more people, we bring more and more people into a beneficial system that prevents, crime, that prevents whatnot. But it's very frustrating. It's a very self-perpetuating system that makes me very angry.
I want to jump to something else. Why are police officers rarely charged for taking the lives of black and brown people? And when they are, why does the jury rarely convict them? And we only have a couple minutes. But this is something that's happening, nationwide. So that's why I wanted to bring this up, because we're looking at all different things. Yes, ma'am.
I feel like I need to vent a little bit on the ruling in the Philando Castile case, because I've seen the video from the, I think there was a belief in the black community that, or I guess like with most people that wanted criminal justice or police reform, that if body cameras were enacted and if there was video from multiple angles, then there would be a difference in the ruling. But in the video in that case, you can very clearly see that he's saying like he says that he has a firearm, he has a concealed carry permit, and he very clearly is not, like, he's reaching for his pocket. And
he tells him to get it.
And
right,
so,
the policeman.
And you can see that, Philando Castile complied, to, every general social construction that we're taught when you're supposed to be interacting with police. And even though, it's sad, but I feel like it's lucky that, that got to an actual trial by jury. And even when it was tried, there was no conviction. And I think that speaks to probably a larger problem within, racial divides, or at least an inability to empathize with or view black men as being essentially like human. And I think that that was saddening. I think it was like a pretty sad reality check.
Well, I think it also stereotypes. I mean, he's a black man. That, from where I sit, would be the first thing that he reacted to.
When we're talking about people's reaction to things, I think that a lot of I guess I'll say demographics that aren't experienced with this kind of thing are generally hesitant to blame law enforcement, because when you start blaming law enforcement, then it's kind of like the people that keep us safe are the ones that are attacking us. So the people who haven't experienced that are like, wait, hold on a second, what did you do wrong? And they try to find things that the person did wrong so that the law enforcement aren't doing things wrong.
Mm-hmm. I think you need to hold law enforcement to a higher standard, though. But I understand the problem.
Well,
I
let
understand
him finish. Your concerns. Did you have – because we only have a few more seconds.
I agree with you. I think that we have to hold law enforcement to a higher standard. But I think that it's hard because a lot of people really don't want to blame law enforcement because they're scared of what that might entail and what that might mean for the future.
Well, and two, I think it's just like a difference in upbringing. Like, I was always taught that police officers were my friends. My best friends growing up, my best friend's father was a police officer. And, like, you know, reading all this news, it's a very new thing to me. And I think a lot of new things, people who were brought up like me.
All right. Well, I thank you to my listening audience. Thanks for the privilege of your ear and time. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.